down for another parley when an explosion shook the room, throwing him to the floor. Vogel leaped on top of Karzai's body to protect him, followed by a scrum of Afghan guards. They feared a Taliban attack was underway. It was friendly fire. An Air Force controller had inadvertently directed a 2,000-pound bomb near Karzai's position. 3 Americans and 50 Afghans died. Karzai was shaken, but not seriously hurt. During the next hour, a BBC reporter called his satellite phone from Kabul to inform him that he had been named chairman of the new Afghan interim government. That same day, a Taliban delegation arrived with a letter of surrender, as Karzai later characterized the document. Karzai asked Mullah Nakibullah, the militarily powerful commander of an armed force in Kandahar, to speak with surviving Taliban leaders who had gathered in Shah Wali Kot, a redoubt of canyons and ridges to Kandahar's northeast. Mullah Muhammad Omar received him. Other senior Taliban leaders and advisers were also present. Karzai was inclined to accept Omar's terms of surrender. The next day, at a Pentagon press conference, however, Donald Rumsfeld announced that any negotiated end of the war against the Taliban was unacceptable to the United States. It remained American policy toward the Taliban to bring justice to them or them to justice. This policy was soon felt in Kandahar. Some of the senior Taliban who offered to back Karzai's new regime were arrested and later sent to Guantanamo. After tense negotiations, the CIA helped to broker a deal in which Gul Aga Sherzai was restored as governor of Kandahar. Nakibullah yielded political power but maintained his armed force, and Hamid Karzai took over national leadership from Kabul. Mullah Muhammad Omar hid out for a few days, wrapped in a shawl, then climbed on a motorcycle and escaped into Pakistan. Hardly anyone in Washington or at the CIA's counter-terrorist center reflected on the Taliban's political fate or how the movement's exclusion from the country's new politics might later create a backlash. Sadly, in terms of our policy, I don't think we thought much about them at all, Crumpton conceded, referring to the Taliban's surviving leadership. We killed a lot of them, many thousands of them, including some of the key leaders. They were whipped. Unfortunately, what we failed to do is to understand that we had to replace the Taliban with something better. As he worked with Karzai and the Northern Alliance to allocate cabinet seats in the new Afghan regime, James Dobbins believed the Taliban had been so discredited by their performance in government and by the speed at which they had been displaced that they were not going to be a significant factor in Afghan politics. That turned out to be completely wrong. In early October, Osama bin Laden issued his first statement since September 11th. "There is America, hit by God in one of its softest spots," he said. "Its greatest buildings were destroyed. Thank God for that. There is America, full of fear from its north to its south." He kept a low profile in the weeks that followed, receiving a few visitors, but moving frequently. When Kabul fell, al-Qaeda's remnant army of Arabs, Uzbeks, Chechens, Africans, and other volunteers mainly evacuated to the east, toward Jalalabad, and then southeast into the White Mountains near the Pakistan border. Bin Laden had constructed underground bunkers there during the anti-Soviet war, at the complex known as Tora Bora. On November 21st, Central Command's Tommy Franks, who was planning air operations against Tora Bora, took a call from Donald Rumsfeld, who ordered him to start working on plans for an invasion of Iraq. Rumsfeld told him to have something ready within a week. That dissonance set the tone for the following 3 weeks. The objective of Operation Enduring Freedom was not to seize Kabul. It was to destroy al-Qaeda. Yet Rumsfeld was ordering the campaign's commander to plan for a different war before he had completed the one at hand. Military history is rife with examples of generals and presidents who squandered strategic advantage by failing to press a battlefield triumph to its conclusion, undermining their victory. Here was the same story again, involving not only complacency, but also inexplicable strategic judgment, fractured decision-making, and confusion. The CIA's days-old Kabul station attempted to track al-Qaeda as its units fled the capital, but the atmosphere was highly improvised, and the station had new leadership. Schroen had pulled out after about 6 weeks in the field, replaced by Gary Burnson. The new chief had grown up on Long Island, where he drank, got into fights, and caused all sorts of trouble, graduating next to last in a high school class of about 300, a functional illiterate. He did not know Afghanistan, but he spoke Farsi and had worked on terrorism operations, where he took a grab-them-by-the-neck approach. Sending him to run CIA operations at the end of October was Hank Crumpton's call. Crumpton wanted aggression on the front line, and he got that. During his short tour in Kabul, Burnson may have advocated more forcefully than anyone in the U.S. government to put American boots on the ground at Tora Bora to try to prevent bin Laden's escape. Yet he also fought so bitterly with colleagues and U.S. military commanders that he undermined his own message. On November 26th or 27th, a CIA officer who was a former Delta operator told Burnson that the small American presence coordinating with Afghan militias was not working. Burnson sent in a careful cable asking for U.S. Rangers. "Let's kill this baby in the crib," he concluded. On November 29th, Vice President Dick Cheney told ABC News that bin Laden was equipped to go to ground at Tora Bora. "He's got what he believes to be secure facilities, caves underground. It's an area he's familiar with." Around December 1st, Crumpton took maps of Tora Bora to the Oval Office and squatted on the floor before President Bush and Cheney to review the terrain. "Is there any way we can seal this border?" Bush asked. "No army on Earth can seal this," Crumpton answered. Delta Force, CIA, and other paramilitary and special forces units were following the method that had conquered Afghanistan's northern cities. They embedded with Afghan militias. Hazrat Ali, a commander in Jalalabad allied with the Northern Alliance, oversaw one force. Haji Zahir, the son of a prominent commander who had initially welcomed bin Laden to Afghanistan, oversaw a smaller one. Neither of them had the motivation or history of collaboration with the CIA that the Panjshirs or Gulag-e Sherzai had. The United States could deploy small reconnaissance units behind the caves and watch for bin Laden and his followers with satellites and the CIA's two predators, Crumpton told Bush. But with such a vast territory and uncertain weather, we could miss their escape. Crumpton felt that he had made an intelligence case emphasizing the Pakistani border was porous, and that he had doubts that Pakistani forces could seal it. He did not think it was his position to recommend directly that Bush deploy hundreds of U.S. troops in a blocking position. As an independent intelligence officer, he had laid out his analysis, but the decision about how to fight the war was up to the president and Franks. The alternative to an American assault force was air power, but Tora Bora had been constructed 15 years before to withstand heavy Soviet aerial bombardment. Franks ordered heavy bombers into action on December 3rd. Over the next 4 days, B-52s and other high-altitude aircraft dropped about 700,000 pounds of explosives on al-Qaeda's suspected positions. Small teams of Delta Force and CIA officers, working with reluctant Afghan militias, pushed up the mountainside to observe what they could. The teams intercepted radio transmissions that included bin Laden speaking to his followers, in the judgment of CIA analysts. But al-Qaeda vastly outnumbered the small American spotting force on the mountain. So did the legions of foreign journalists covering the fight from around Jalalabad. Several days after Crumpton's Oval Office meeting, around December 4th, Burnson demanded that the United States put more of its own boots on the ground. He almost screamed over the phone to Crumpton that U.S. Army Rangers or Marines were needed in the mountains. Crumpton briefed Kofor Black and then called Tommy Franks the next morning in Tampa. They had a long conversation. Crumpton urged the general to deploy American troops onto the mountainsides. Franks, expressed concern about the lack of planning and the time required to deploy substantial reinforcements, as Crumpton put it later. That afternoon, Crumpton briefed Kofor Black and George Tenet about where they stood. When Crumpton described Central Command's reluctance to Burnson, the Kabul station chief only cursed. Crumpton answered that Burnson had to accept Franks' decision and go with what we have. Bush later defended his own decision-making on the grounds that he asked our commanders and CIA officials about bin Laden frequently, and they assured me they had the troop levels and resources they needed. But Crumpton's view was that Central Command had to provide the critical blocking forces on the ground. That was well beyond the CIA's capacity. In Kabul, Burnson met Major General Del Daley, who commanded Joint Special Operations Command, the subunit of special forces housing elite counterterrorism units such as Delta Force and the Navy SEALs. Daley told Burnson that he would not deploy more American troops to Tora Bora because it might arouse resentment from Afghan allies. "I don't give a damn about offending our allies," Burnson shouted. Daley refused to change his mind. In fact, the decisions were being made at higher levels. "Screw that," Burnson answered. United States Senate investigators later concluded that about 2,000 to 3,000 American troops would have been required to make an effective attempt to block al-Qaeda's escape from Tora Bora. About 1,000 soldiers from the 10th Mountain Division had deployed nearby to Uzbekistan, where they had no significant mission. 1,000 Marines sat at Camp Rhino, southeast of Kandahar, with no significant mission. With reinforcements from the U.S. Army Rangers and the 82nd Airborne flying out of the United States, a substantial blocking force was available. Organizing enough high-altitude helicopter lift, supplies, and medical support would have been challenging and risky under such time pressure. The peaks at Tora Bora rose as high as 14,000 feet, meaning that American soldiers training at lower altitude and dropped in suddenly might suffer from altitude sickness. Because of the harsh weather and rough terrain, close air support would have been difficult to deliver, leaving ground troops vulnerable to ambush or capture. Yet various accounts given by Franks and his lieutenants indicate that Central Command's reluctance to bear risk was as much the product of a political judgment as it was about logistics. The generals feared the deployment behind Tora Bora might provoke a tribal revolt in the mountains or otherwise destabilize Afghan politics. History misguided them. The cataclysms and mass slaughters suffered by Soviet and British invaders of Afghanistan led Franks and Lieutenant General Michael DeLong, his deputy, to believe that the sudden arrival of hundreds of American soldiers among armed Pashtun tribesmen might stir a spontaneous uprising, they said later. As DeLong put it, "We wanted to create a stable country, and that was more important than going after bin Laden at the time." He feared that this tribal area was sympathetic to bin Laden. The reluctance to go in heavy with American forces began at the top, with Rumsfeld and Franks. According to Major General Warren Edwards, who was involved in the operation, "The message was strong from the national level down. We are not going to repeat the mistakes of the Soviets. We are not going to go in with large conventional forces." This precept was embedded in our decision-making process, in our psyche. In fact, the pattern of local responses to heavily armed NATO troops deploying for short periods in Pashtun regions would later make clear that even when locals were sullen or hostile, they did not typically have the means or will to mount a spontaneous armed uprising. That would only invite bombing and other deadly retaliation from a vastly superior American force. In the longer run, alienated Pashtuns across the south and east would join or aid the Taliban against the United States, but those populations almost certainly did not pose the threat to a short-term deployment at Tora Bora in December that DeLong and others feared. On December 9th, Crumpton informed Burnson that he was being replaced after only a few weeks in country. Burnson had alienated analysts and operators at the Counter-Terrorist Center and Alec Station. When he learned of his removal, he felt as though someone had just thrown a bucket of cold water in my face. He could not understand the decision. Why was headquarters pulling us out? And why was Washington hesitant about committing troops to get bin Laden? Crumpton felt Berenson had done a magnificent, heroic job. But Afghanistan was about to form a post-Taliban government, and there would be a new mission for the CIA in Kabul that required a strong station chief. Crumpton believed he had to manage sudden success and the impending political transformation from a Taliban-occupied country to a liberated proto-state in need of a central authority. This required a chief of station who could engage across the entire U.S. national security spectrum and forge a close working relationship with the emerging Afghan national government. That might be so, but it did not explain why it was necessary to deliver this news to Berenson and his frontline team before the Tora Bora battle was resolved. Berenson was furious and punched a hole in a door at the Ariana Hotel. He had to sheepishly watch Afghan workmen repair it the next day while he ran a meeting. But he turned back to the fight. He was pretty angry about being ordered back, but 3,000 people had been killed on September 11th, so the decision had no negative effect on my performance. He had a sore fist, however. Tommy Frank said later that, in addition to heavy bombing, his plan was to help Pakistan's army block al-Qaeda's exit. He thought it was a pretty good determination to work with the Pakistanis. But the CIA reported immediately that the plan would fail, according to Charles Allen, who was in charge of agency intelligence collection at the time. On December 11th, at CIA headquarters, Allen's directorate composed the first edition of what would become a daily Hunt for Bin Laden classified memo, intended for Tenet, Bush, and key members of the National Security Cabinet. The early editions concentrated on Tora Bora and emphasized that the back door was open, by Allen's account. The Pakistani generals in charge of closing the back door had no means to airlift troops high into the Hindu Kush Mountains in the time available. When they asked the United States for help, they were turned down. Pakistan's then Director General of Military Operations, in charge of all day-to-day military movements, later said that he first learnt about Tora Bora from the television, and that the Pakistan Army Command's reaction to the battle was one of alarm. This account is supported by other Pakistani generals then stationed along the border. Only by December 8th or 9th, after days of heavy bombing had taken place, did Franks ask the Pakistan Army's 11 Corps to seal the border. Pakistan had few troop-carrying helicopters. The Army did move ground forces into the region by truck, but this only blocked a few routes of escape from Afghanistan. Was bin Laden really there? Charles Allen and a Delta Force major who at the time scrutinized intercepts of a radio speech bin Laden apparently delivered on December 10th concluded that he was, as did the operations officers and analysts back at Alex Station. It later materialized that bin Laden wrote his last will and testament on December 14th. The document's tone and content suggest he thought he would die soon. Its tone adds to the likelihood that bin Laden was at Tora Bora, under the bombs. Allah bears witness that the love of jihad and death in the cause of Allah has dominated my life, and the verses of the sword permeated every cell in my heart. And fight the pagans all together as they fight you all together, he wrote. He apologized to his children for the hardship he had created in their lives and asked his wives never to remarry. It was probably the next day that he left for Pakistan. The CIA's Allen hypothesized that bin Laden moved north inside Afghanistan into Kunar and Nuristan provinces before crossing over to Pakistan. Scores of bin Laden's al-Qaeda followers who survived the bombing walked or rode into Pakistan. Arabs, Chechens, Uzbeks, some wounded and ill, all seeking shelter. Tommy Franks flew into Islamabad to meet Musharraf over lunch in the midst of this migration. Chamberlain attended. Musharraf asked, General Franks, what are you doing? You are flushing these guys out, and there are 150 valleys for them to move through. They are pouring into my country." Franks did not have an answer. Musharraf asked Franks if Central Command could hurriedly provide helicopters to lift 60,000 Pakistani troops to the Afghan border. Trapping al-Qaeda's 1,000-odd hardcore survivors inside Afghanistan was as much in Pakistan's interest as it was in America's, as al-Qaeda's migration into Pakistan could wreak havoc. Franks did not answer at the time, but later communicated to Musharraf that it could not be done. Helicopters were in short supply. President Bush heard conflicting advice throughout the fall of 2001 about how much Osama bin Laden mattered as an individual target. Some of his advisers argued that Bush should avoid equating al-Qaeda with the United States by singling bin Laden out. It is true that bin Laden's position was not that of a commanding general, or even a guerrilla leader comparable to Mao Zedong or Fidel Castro. He was the chairman of a force of multinational volunteers who sometimes worked autonomously and had no political territory of their own. After bin Laden disappeared, it was tempting for Bush and his advisers to believe that his survival didn't matter much, apart from the need to deliver justice on behalf of al-Qaeda's victims in New York, Washington, Nairobi, Dar es Salaam, and elsewhere. But the failure at Tora Bora ran deeper than justice delayed. As Senate investigators later concluded, the events at Tora Bora forever altered the course of the conflict in Afghanistan and the future of international terrorism. It also altered the future of Pakistan. On the eve of the American attack on Afghanistan, Dick Cheney had warned Bush's war cabinet that the war could spill over into Pakistan, causing the government to lose control of the country and potentially its nuclear arsenal. Stephen Hadley, Bush's then-deputy national security adviser, called this the nightmare scenario. Pentagon planners had listed the collapse of the Pakistani government as one of the risks of the campaign from the outset. Now the migration of hundreds of Uzbeks, Chechens, Arabs, and other foreign fighters from the eastern mountains of Afghanistan into Pakistan's tribal areas and cities brought that nightmare scenario into being. Al-Qaeda's arrival created conditions that would further destabilize Pakistan. It connected the country's indigenous radical networks with al-Qaeda's international ideologists. It deepened resentment among Pakistan's generals, who had come to see their country's rising violence as a price of American folly in the fall of 2001. The potency of al-Qaeda's ideas and tactics further challenged a Pakistani state that was weak, divided, complacent, and complicit about Islamist ideology and violence. These consequences were not fully apparent that December, but they would rapidly metastasize. American politicians and media celebrated Operation Enduring Freedom as a great and stunning campaign, a harbinger of a new kind of war. The operation did succeed faster and at a lower cost in American lives than any comparable war in the country's history. The CIA, Navy and Air Force planners and Special Operations Command developed and executed in less than 4 weeks an improvised, successful attack in a large, distant, landlocked country. Special Forces teams fought remarkably alongside Afghan forces that were themselves courageous and daring. Of course, the Taliban had no modern air defenses, no significant air force, no economy, and no powerful allies. Even so, few would have dared to predict on the night of October 7th that by mid-December, the Taliban would be out of power entirely, or that an opposition government led by Hamid Karzai and recognized by the United Nations would be installed, or that the U.S.-led coalition would have suffered only 12 military deaths, as well as the death of one CIA officer, Johnny Michael Spann. Operation Enduring Freedom was a military, political, intelligence endeavor of great ingenuity, luck, and tactical skill. Its success blinded many American politicians, commanders, and CIA leaders to the losses inflicted on Afghans and the political risks of their strategy. The U.S.-led coalition dropped about 12,000 bombs on Afghanistan that autumn, about 40% of them dumb or unguided, according to an analysis by Carl Canetta of the Center for International Policy. Hank Crumpton at the Counterterrorist Center estimated that the campaign killed at least 10,000 foreign and Taliban fighters, perhaps double or triple that number. By the conservative estimate of Boston University political scientist Nita Crawford, between 1,500 and 2,375 Afghan civilians also died. Some perished in plainly avoidable mistakes when American bombers destroyed civilian villages and extended families. The arbitrariness of these civilian deaths planted seeds of bitterness. So did the CIA's revived client, Abdul Rashid Dostum, who accepted the surrender of several thousand Taliban and allied prisoners in November. Hundreds of those prisoners soon died from suffocation after being stuffed into shipping containers or shot by guards. Dostum said he was in Kunduz, did not order the actions that led to the deaths, and did not learn about them until a year later. In any event, the Bush administration did nothing to hold anyone accountable for the massacres. Dostum entered politics and soon held high office. The United States had no serious plan for Afghanistan after the war. The nearly uniform worldwide support for Hamid Karzai's interim government created a framework for massive reconstruction and for new politics. Yet the Bush administration had little appetite for nation-building or peacekeeping. Osama bin Laden and Mullah Muhammad Omar had escaped. Afghanistan's cities lay in the hands of strongmen, many of them CIA clients, whose previous turns in office had been marked by abuse, internecine fighting, and incompetence. 30 years of war, and now, after Operation Enduring Freedom, thousands of additional bombs dropped on the country, had left Afghanistan prostrate. Life expectancy and child mortality rates, to the extent they could be measured at all, stood at the very bottom of the UN's worldwide human development tables. The country's only real equities were international goodwill and some collective memory of a multi-ethnic country that had once been peaceful. Hamid Karzai invited Greg Vogel to his inauguration in Kabul on December 22nd. The new Afghan leader wore a lambskin hat and spoke in Pashto and Dari. Shouts and warm applause punctuated an emotional ceremony. From the ashes of September 11th, a ruined country had won a new beginning. "We should put our hands together to forget the painful past," Karzai said. Part 2. Losing the Peace, 2002 to 2006. Chapter 6. Small Change. Rich Blee flew to Bagram Airfield in mid-December 2001. Kabul's thin mountain air was smoky from cooking fires, and winter was biting. He spent some of his first days in country arranging for turkeys to be acquired by Afghan staff and then deep-fried for Christmas dinner to lift the morale of Kabul Station. Hank Crumpton and Kofor Black had asked him to serve as the new chief of station. He took a crammed 3-day refresher course in shooting M-16s and AK-47s and packed up. Kabul made Banji, in the Central African Republic, the site of Blee's first CIA posting, seem stable and well-provisioned. The Taliban had unplugged the city. The international airport had no air traffic control systems to speak about. Only satellite phones could be relied upon for voice communication. Gasoline and diesel had to be flown in by the barrel. The Taliban had squatted inside ministry buildings. They cooked on the floor and slept in offices. Sections of the city destroyed by street-to-street tank and rocket battles during the Civil War still lay in ruins. After Kabul fell to the Northern Alliance, the Panjshiris and their Uzbek and Hazara allies had rushed from building to building, reoccupying lost property or seizing abandoned compounds. The armed militias created an unstable patchwork of policing and checkpoints from block to block. The CIA's redoubt, the old Ariana Hotel, was a wreck. Kabul Station became a daily improvisation. The expatriates slept in shifts. The four-story hotel faced a traffic circle downtown, protected by a 10-foot wall. The CIA's new staff built more walls and tried to push out the perimeter. The hotel had advantages: furnished rooms that could be used as bunks or as offices, and an Afghan staff seemingly eager to serve a reliable paymaster. Yet some of the staff had worked for the Taliban before the Americans arrived. Their loyalties might be judged as uncertain. The dining room still functioned. The Ariana was close to the presidential palace, which made it easy for Blee to drop in on Karzai. Still, the place was truly decrepit. A Northern Alliance jet had dropped a bomb on the hotel a few years back. CIA officers chasing Al-Qaeda into the White Mountains brought back a stray puppy and insisted that it be adopted. The dog slept on the hotel floors and crapped in hallways as it pleased. Blee soon ordered the puppy banished, one of his more unpopular decisions. Bearded special operators and case officers with Glock pistols strapped to their thighs tromped in and out. The atmosphere was a cross between a Central Asian organized crime clubhouse and a clabbered hotel on a muddy street in an old western. The CIA had no institutional view about what should be done in Afghanistan after the Taliban. Blee and Hank Crumpton favored a major reconstruction program to signal American commitment. Kofor Black thought the United States had a poor record of transforming countries like Afghanistan. He favored a light footprint and an unrelenting focus on Al-Qaeda. In any event, the CIA was supposed to offer presidents empirical intelligence and analysis and to steer clear of foreign policy advice. Yet agency operations created de facto policy in Afghanistan during 2002 by empowering strongmen with poor human rights records. The CIA's overall playbook that winter in Afghanistan was derived from its operations in Vietnam, Nicaragua, Angola, Somalia, and other Cold War proxy conflicts, in which many of the senior officers at the counter-terrorist center had served. Station chiefs managed palace politics with cash, favors, and confidential advice to national leaders, while watching out for the influence of rival intelligence services. The Special Activities Division trained and paid rough militias as armed reconnaissance forces to provide protection to expatriate case officers and to operate in contested areas or behind enemy lines. Career case officers recruited locals as reporting agents and vetted their information against satellite and predator imagery or phone chatter picked up by the National Security Agency. To carry out such operations, the CIA inevitably favored as political officeholders tough men independent of foreign intelligence services who would act reliably on American priorities. This client network would create a new landscape of winners in Afghanistan. George W. Bush had given the CIA one clear mandate: to attack Al-Qaeda and its allies. As a practical matter, that meant Blee's operating directive for Kabul Station prioritized pursuit of the Arab, Chechen, and Uzbek volunteers who had followed bin Laden east and then melted away after the bombing of Tora Bora. No one knew their numbers, but the best estimates were in the range of several hundred up to 2,000 foreigners, that is, non-Afghans and non-Pakistanis. This was Al-Qaeda's loose remnant army. Embedded within its ranks were the bomb experts, money men, and ex-Arab military officers who organized the cells that often conceived and backed the most ambitious overseas terror strikes. By January 2002, some Al-Qaeda foot soldiers and unit commanders had migrated into Pakistan. But others had gone to ground in eastern Afghanistan, along the mountainous border from Jalalabad south toward Paktika province. As early as mid-December, intelligence analysts at Task Force Dagger, the Special Forces Command, whose A-teams had embedded with the Northern Alliance as they defeated the Taliban, had concluded that significant numbers of Al-Qaeda were regrouping around Paktia and Gardez. Blee recruited Chris Wood as the incipient Kabul Station's chief of operations, in charge of the CIA's collaboration with special forces to the east. Wood had no military experience, but his Dari skills and his experience with the Pancheries during the autumn campaign recommended him, as well as the fact that he had spent the previous 4 years in Islamabad running Afghan agents. There were only about 30 or 40 CIA officers left in Afghanistan by the time of Karzai's inauguration, although the number would grow again during 2002. The Pentagon's special forces, soldiers, and officers now outnumbered case officers by about fivefold. The American-led units formed a push into eastern Afghanistan to chase al-Qaeda remnants, comprised mixed teams of special forces, Green Berets, Delta Force, and Navy SEAL Team 6, plus CIA officers and communications and intercept specialists. They were eventually referred to as Omega Teams. They might operate independently on reconnaissance missions to identify al-Qaeda positions, or they might train and accompany Afghan militias of several hundred or more men. The CIA officers on the teams included paramilitary specialists such as Greg Vogel, but also language and area specialists like Chris Wood, who led a reconnaissance team that winter of 2002 that operated along the twisting highway between Khost and Gardez. Intelligence operations have a range, like radar or rifles, Wood told colleagues. CIA tradecraft held that case officers should try to operate tens of miles from denied territory in order to run agents behind enemy lines. To recruit Afghan militias that could provide local support, the CIA turned to Amrullah Saleh and to Asadullah Khalid, a Pashtun from Ghazni province in the east. Khalid was then in his early 30s. His father had served in parliament during the pre-communist era. Before 2001, as Sayaf's intelligence aide, Asadullah had traveled to the United States and worked with the CIA on programs to recover Stinger missiles and collect intelligence on al-Qaeda. Like Saleh, he was young, relatively independent, game for action, and implacably opposed to the Taliban. More established commanders in the Northern Alliance, such as Fahim Khan and Abdul-Rashid Dostum, controlled large armed forces, but they worked simultaneously with the CIA, Iranian intelligence, and Russian intelligence. Asadullah was less entangled in these relationships. By early 2002, he had become a partner of the CIA for reasons of mutual advantage, as a European security officer put it. In their weakness, they became friends of the Americans and gained strength. The Americans built up small forward bases to train and prepare their hastily recruited forces. Early in the new year, they reinforced a forward operating base on the outskirts of Gardez, a provincial capital 80 miles due south from Kabul, in a fortress compound with 25-foot mud brick walls and a steel gate, located at about 7,000 feet above sea level. Gardez became a hub of clandestine and unconventional warfare planning and intelligence collection. CIA case officers and Green Berets rode out to local villages, met elders, offered food and medical aid, and sought out traveling Afghan agents who might be paid $50 or $100 to ride or walk into districts where al-Qaeda might be holed up. "It's a little like Star Wars," as an officer involved put it. "We would send these little agents all over the place to try to find where the Rebel Alliance was. And if the agents didn't come back, or they came back dead, or they couldn't get past roadblocks, we knew there was a problem." The essential questions plumbed by the CIA's agents were, where are the al-Qaeda who fled Tora Bora but remained in Afghanistan? What weapons and defenses do they have? How many are there? Michael Hurley, a senior CIA case officer deployed at Gardez from December 2001 to May 2002, worked on the big question after Tora Bora, which was, where is the last redoubt in Afghanistan? Yet it was difficult to sort rumor from fact. Paying impoverished locals for information created financial incentives for them to invent tantalizing false stories or settle vendettas by labeling a business or tribal rival as al-Qaeda. Even where multiple sources confirmed that foreign fighters were present, according to Hurley, Local agents weren't very good about sorting out foreigners' nationalities or determining which leaders might be with them. In January, Major General Warren Edwards of Central Command flew into Kabul and met with Rich Blee. The station chief told him that he expected the last battle of the Afghan War to be fought soon around Gardez. Edwards took note. In his experience, Blee had a much better feel for Afghanistan than most of the people I talked to. By late January, the fire ants, as the CIA human agents run mainly out of Gardez were known, reported with increasing credibility the existence of a large group of foreign al-Qaeda fighters in the Shaikot Valley, to the southeast of Gardez. The valley floor stood at 8,500 feet above sea level, and the surrounding peaks rose as high as 14,000 feet. Shaikot had been an al-Qaeda sanctuary during the 1980s, as well as a redoubt of the Haqqanis, a family-led network of Afghan Taliban allies. We had estimates of 200 to 300 people, up to 1,200 to 1,400, Hurley recalled. Task Force Dagger's intelligence analysts assessed the foreigners as mainly from the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, an al-Qaeda ally. But the analysts could not confirm the numbers of enemy present through predator photography, U-2 surveillance planes, or satellite imagery. The weather was bad, the valley ridgelines had caves that were difficult to penetrate, and there was no sign of a large force in the open. Maybe they weren't there. Maybe they had adopted strong measures to avoid detection. The CIA lost a couple of reporting agents who were captured and executed, and we ran into a couple of roadblocks, and they were manned by Chechens and Uzbeks, according to an officer involved. We knew that was bad, but we didn't know how many. Major General Franklin Buster Hagenbeck, a West Point graduate who commanded the 10th Mountain Division and who was then the highest-ranking officer commanding conventional forces in the country, organized planning exercises at Bagram Airfield for an attack on the Shaikot. His officers built a terrain model of the region on the floor of an old Soviet hangar. Hagenbeck and his men walked through it every day, wargaming their plan. Among other things, Hagenbeck and his lieutenants sought to absorb the lessons of Tora Bora, to plan from the start for the deployment of reliable American and allied NATO forces, led by the 101st Airborne Division, behind al-Qaeda's positions, to prevent the enemy's escape into Pakistan. Where were Osama bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri? There were reports of his presence at Jalalabad, Peshawar, and Kandahar. None of these panned out, and increasingly there were no good leads. Yet there were plenty of false sightings of both men that had to be run down by Kabul Station. At one point, an Afghan Tajik vendor in Utah contacted his congressman and persuaded him to inform the Pentagon that the vendor knew where bin Laden was hiding, near Gardez. The military spun up an operation to attack the site. It turned out that the FBI had previously documented that the source was a fabricator. From Langley, Charles Allen circulated his daily bin Laden hunt memo for about 3 months after Tora Bora, but he dropped it when the leads ran dry. Allen consulted case officers who had served in Pakistan. They suggested regions where Allen might look around, such as the northern Pakistani border city of Chitral and the Swat Valley. He went into Langley headquarters on weekends to take a hard look at the satellite and other overhead imagery with analysts, but they found nothing. One hypothesis was that bin Laden had actually died at Tora Bora. But when FBI forensic teams, working with special forces, exhumed al-Qaeda gravesites there, they identified some of bin Laden's bodyguards, but found no trace of the leader himself. Kabul Station became a destination for visitors from Washington, all of whom Blee and his deputy had to brief, protect, and entertain. Among the early arrivals was A.B. Buzzy Krongard, the CIA's executive director, a wealthy former investment banker from Baltimore, whom Tenet had recruited a few years before to bring private sector management expertise to agency operations. A Princeton-educated lawyer and former Marine, Krongard lived in a hillside mansion outside of Baltimore that had a private shooting range. He had a large gun collection. Like Tenet, He had an expansive personality. Krongard toured Kabul and Gardez. Tenet sent Jose Rodriguez of the Counterterrorist Center as an escort, just to make sure Buzzy doesn't kill anybody, as Rodriguez told colleagues. The visit was another distraction, but it produced a momentous decision. Krongard was struck by how insecure Kabul Station seemed, even though the war was supposedly won. Inside the Ariana Hotel, officers carried a weapon even to the bathroom. Krongard had known Blee when he worked on the 7th floor as an aide to Tenet and admired him. They discussed the Afghan guard force protecting the Ariana Hotel. Blee had to assume the CIA's address was no secret around Kabul. If they were attacked, Blee said, you could have the whole hotel in a firing position, but we don't know if the Afghans will fight, leave, or lead the enemy in. At one point, the CIA conducted an internal security review of Kabul Station and found the facility to be virtually indefensible. It was a hotel, and hotels are meant to be accessible. The guards' primary loyalty was to the Northern Alliance, not the CIA. Krongard pledged to do something when he got back to Langley. The CIA contracted for training facilities with Blackwater USA, the private firm run by Eric Prince, a former Navy SEAL. According to Krongard, he had never worked with Prince directly before early 2002, but they knew of each other. After Krongard returned to Langley, Prince, who was in CIA headquarters, made a cold call at Krongard's office, seeking to identify how Blackwater could grow its business at the agency. Prince asked what needs the CIA had. Krongard mentioned his Kabul Station issue. I've got a Rolodex, Prince said, meaning a network of former non-commissioned officers, special forces, and retired SEALs. Go down to the contract office, Krongard told him. As Krongard recalled it, let's move, was the attitude. Blackwater's for-profit provision of bodyguards, shooters, spies, and other operatives in the global war on terrorism was born. Weeks later, Kabul Station had a special expatriate protection force in place, organized by Prince. The militia and reconnaissance operations Chris Wood oversaw in Afghanistan's east early in 2002 constituted one leg of the CIA's counterterrorism strategy in post-Taliban Afghanistan. A second was to fund the reconstruction of the National Directorate of Security, Afghanistan's intelligence and security service. The CIA now had the opportunity to shape a friendly intelligence agency at the axis of Central and South Asia. The mandate of NDS approximately combined those of the FBI and the CIA in the United States. After the Panjshiris took Kabul, Engineer Arif returned to NDS as de facto chief, on Fahim Khan's orders. Karzai formally appointed Arif as his interim government's head of intelligence in late December 2001. As a practical matter, Karzai had no choice. The Panjshiris constituted the main armed power in Kabul at the time, and he was, in effect, their international representative. Arif was a problematic partner for the CIA. He had contacts with Russians and Iranians dating back years. The NDS still carried the influence of its years as a stepchild of the KGB. Also, before September 11th, Massoud had entrusted Arif with selling the Panjshir's gemstones to fund the war effort, emeralds, rubies, and lapis lazuli mined in Northern Alliance territory. Each year, Arif would load up trucks the size of coffee tables and fly to Las Vegas for the American Gem Trade Association exhibition. He would make $3 million to $4 million for the Northern Alliance cause, but along the way, he seemed to develop a taste for comfortable hotels and condominiums. He flew on the supersonic Concorde at least once, quite possibly the only Panjshiri ever to do so. At CIA headquarters early that winter, the CIA's longtime South Asia hand, Gary Schroen, sat at a desk with a legal pad and a calculator and drew up an outline for funding the Afghan service, which he hoped to work through with Engineer Arif. He modeled the prospective service on the SAVAK, the Shah's intelligence service before the Iranian Revolution, which Schroen had studied. In February, Schroen flew to Kabul. He was dismayed to learn that Arif wanted to move temporarily with his family to Washington, D.C. to seek medical attention. Arif had developed a sciatic nerve problem. He said his wife also needed counseling to work through the lingering effects of her traumatic experiences during the Soviet War. His wife's father had been killed by the Soviets. As a teenager, she had then taken a position on the household staff of a Russian officer, shot him in revenge, and fled, according to what Arif told the CIA. Schroen agreed to support Arif. After all, the Pancheris had gone to great lengths to accommodate the CIA at the agency's hour of need in the autumn of 2001. Arif and his family moved into a safe house in the Washington area. Schroen arranged medical appointments. Weeks passed, and still Arif was in no hurry to return to Kabul. He was trying to run Afghan intelligence with a fax machine from his CIA guest house. One rumor was that Arif might be reluctant to return to Afghanistan because he had fallen under suspicion among some Panjshiris because of Massoud's assassination. Arif had cleared the Al-Qaeda assassins for their interview with the commander, and then he had left the room before the suicide bombing took place. In fact, there was no basis for the suspicion, but as Arif put it, Massoud's death had a negative psychological effect on the people and the leadership of the United Front. For his part, Schroen could understand why such suspicions might arise, but he could not see why Arif would have any motive to collaborate in Massoud's death. Arif had been loyal to Massoud for years. In any event, whatever his reasons for remaining in the United States, after 2 months, Arif at last returned to Kabul. The suspicions about him subsided. Everyone knew Arif was not a killer, as one of his Panjshiri colleagues put it. The larger question was what sort of intelligence and security service the CIA would build in Afghanistan. NDS had roots tracing to the 19th century. As the Afghan state grew more centralized, Kabul's kings built intelligence networks in villages and provincial capitals to ensure that the palace had early warning about political threats. These networks reported to a security bureau in the palace. The Soviet occupation converted this into KHAD, a monstrosity constructed in the KGB's image, and a feared instrument of political and social control. KHAD had 150,000 or more Afghans on its payroll at its peak, including paramilitaries. It had provincial offices and numbered directorates. The directorate names changed from time to time, but at the height of the Soviet era, Directorate 1 ran external operations, Directorate 5 was in charge of counterterrorism, Directorate 6 ran counterintelligence, and Directorate 7 was in charge of monitoring universities, madrasas, and political elites for their loyalty to the state. When Engineer Arif ran NDS in the early 1990s, he kept on some KHAD veterans. When the Taliban took power, they renamed the service and brought in former communists from a different faction. This was the CIA's inheritance, a workforce of opaque subgroups that had operated torture chambers and prisons, intimidated citizens across the land, and that owed its professional culture mainly to the KGB. The budget Engineer Arif worked with initially was about $15 million annually, and although this could support hundreds of intelligence officers and even more support staff, it was far short of what would be required to attempt to create a national police force or an FBI equivalent for Afghanistan. In any event, that lay well beyond the ambitions of Bush administration policy that winter. The CIA's mission was Al-Qaeda. Langley's hesitancy to fund NDS aggressively only grew as CIA officers noticed that the funds they did provide did not seem to be producing the kinds of visible results they would have expected, while Arif seemed to be living beyond the means of a civil servant. Arif said that any accusation of personal corruption was unfair, but if the concern was organizational corruption within NDS, there were some problems because of the war situation and the lack of control over NDS personnel outside Kabul. Eventually, Arif would occupy an expansive compound in the Panjshir, a Kabul home, and a high-rise apartment in the United Arab Emirates. It was simpler for the CIA to work directly with the individuals they knew and trusted best, Amrullah Saleh, Asadullah Khalid, and Hamid Karzai. Arif also accommodated the agency at first. Among his assignments, Saleh ran counterintelligence at NDS, as well as liaisons with foreign spy services. Arif named Khalid the head of Directorate 5, in charge of counterterrorism. "We wanted to rescue Afghanistan from the darkness, to take this country that had been imprisoned and free it, place it inside the normal international community," an Afghan official involved recalled. "But we did not control this change. It was controlled by the United States." Operation Anaconda, commanded by Major General Hagenbeck, opened on March 2nd. It would be the largest U.S. military operation since the Gulf War of early 1991, as well as the highest altitude battle ever fought by a sizable U.S. force. In Not a Good Day to Die, the journalist Sean Naylor provides an independent-minded, well-sourced account of the operation. Special forces, CIA officers, and an Afghan militia loyal to Ziauddin attempted the main attack across the valley floor, but withdrew after an American Spectre gunship mistakenly shot up Lawton's men. Bombing and intrepid fighting at close quarters by American and Allied forces killed dozens and perhaps hundreds of al-Qaeda holed up on high ridges. Greg Vogel fought with Afghan militiamen and later received the CIA's equivalent of the Medal of Honor for battlefield valor after he rallied Afghans who had been left behind back into the fight. But Anaconda witnessed failures of planning and execution, the product of the fractured lines of command. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had imposed a hard cap on the number of American soldiers allowed on the ground in Afghanistan. The total deployment would average 5,200 through the summer of 2002. The great majority of those forces were immobile at the bases at Bagram and Kandahar. Even the roving target-hunting special operators were stretched thin, given the vast length of the Afghan-Pakistan border and the size of the remnant al-Qaeda force thought to have moved there. Britain, Australia, Denmark, Norway, Poland, New Zealand, Canada, and other allies had sent special forces units to Afghanistan, but organizing them to fight al-Qaeda required a unified command that did not exist. There were two Special Forces task forces, one headquartered in Uzbekistan, a second in Kandahar, that operated independently. Hagenbeck putatively commanded all U.S. forces in Afghanistan, yet he did not control the special operators. And the general did not have his full headquarters or division with him. The command design was a prescription for error. The 10th Mountain Division had originally been deployed to provide security at a transit base in Uzbekistan. Its units were not properly trained, manned, or equipped for the battle they were ordered to fight, a Naval War College assessment later found. The absence of a fully functioning intelligence cell made errors inevitable. According to Hagenbeck, there were several important intelligence failures. They expected al-Qaeda forces to retreat under fire, as they did at Tora Bora. Instead, they fought to the death and summoned reinforcements. There were about 300 more al-Qaeda volunteers in the valley than anticipated. There were four times as many caves as forecast, meaning the enemy had ample places to shelter. Central Command prohibited American forces from using artillery in Afghanistan at this time, for fear of civilian casualties that would evoke memories of brutal Soviet tactics. That meant close air support would be essential to protect soldiers if they were ambushed or encountered heavier al-Qaeda forces than expected. Yet the commander of the Combined Air Operations Center in Saudi Arabia, whose planes would provide that close air support, did not even learn of Operation Anaconda until 5 days before the scheduled launch. The blocking forces attempting to squeeze the enemy encountered much heavier al-Qaeda resistance on the ridges than had been expected. In the end, U.S. forces suffered 8 dead and about 80 wounded in 4 days of heavy fighting. That was a light toll compared with many past American battles. But it was more than half the number of dead suffered in all of Operation Enduring Freedom the previous fall. One death was especially shocking. Neil Roberts, a Navy SEAL, fell out of a helicopter as it attempted to land under fire. Roberts lay abandoned on the snow as Al-Qaeda surrounded him. He fired back, but was